Audi.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Michael Palin describes Trevor Dolby's book, One Place L'Église, as a timeless story of what it is that makes France irresistible. Former publisher Trevor and his wife Kaz discovered the medieval ruin just off the local village square, and the resulting book, widely known as The New Year in Provence, follows them as they navigate language difficulties, floods and freezing winters, colourful characters in the local bar, all with the backdrop of the scent of thyme and lavender, the warmth of sun on stone walls, night hung with stars, and how they come to create their perfectly imperfect French home. Trevor Dolby is on the Big Travel Podcast. Tell me about this beautiful sounding house. I've had a look through the book, and the house in the medieval square, the medieval house in the medieval square.
Well, it was it's part of a circularde, which is a defensive structure around sometimes a village, often a church, and our house is part of that wall, and it's built on the inside of it. And it was built contiguous with the church, which was around 1050 started. And our house was originally part of the stabling on one side, and then the other side of the gate was where the guards inhabited. And pretty much everything down in the south of France, in Languedoc particularly, which ran right the way across from Spain, almost to the Italian border in those times, was fortified. And the reason for that was the Albigensians. There was this, the Albigensian Crusade, which was an extraordinarily bloody religious battle, which went on for 40 or 50 years and went from one side of the Languedoc to the other and kept ebbing and flowing, culminating or certainly punctuated very notoriously with a massacre in Béziers Cathedral, where upwards of 10,000 people were massacred by Simon de Montfort. And it's utterly notorious because they went into the cathedral grounds from all around the countryside, and they were besieged, and he eventually broke the siege and murdered everybody. So every city, every small town, every village in that area is fortified, and there's circulars. And over the years, it's been a school, it's been a mairie, it's been a home. But over the last 20 years or so, it was abandoned. And it's a very strange thing. This is not the case now, but certainly 20 years ago, when we were buying the house, if you went through a village in the south of France, and you would kind of find old houses which were almost tumbling down. And it was a strange thing, partly because people were moving out into the lotissement, which are the little surrounding villages, surrounding housing estates, where the houses were new and you could heat them. But also because of the strange inheritance system in France, where in the UK, you know, the inheritance is usually to one or two people. In France, it goes to everybody. And as a consequence, a lot of them were either in fights with people who couldn't decide whether they should sell it or not, or it was because the tax system in those days, if you inherited something, you had to pay 40% tax on it or thereabouts. And then over a period of time, it would reduce to nothing. So what used to happen, somebody would die, the house would become empty, they'd lock it and walk away from it because they'd want to pay the tax. That was very similar to what happened with our house. And when we first saw it, we were taken in, or I was taken in, and that's another story. I saw the house myself and didn't take my wife, who when we bought it, had never seen it. Don't do this, everybody. This is not good advice.
I've actually done it, but yeah.
She loves it, I have to say. When I walked into it, it had literally been locked for nearly 20 years, and everything in there was as if somebody had just walked out the door with a layer of dust and grit on it, and windows broken because of think over the years, you know, the floors crumbling. The old lady who had lived in there, her bed was still there, still made up, and photographs of her and her family on the walls. And, you know, it was an extraordinary thing. When I walked in, I was just captivated. The immobilier, the estate agent, took one look at it and tried to grab my arm and drag me out and say, "You don't want to do this. This has got nightmare written all over it." And I said, no, this is amazing. I have to see more. And I remember going into the old lady's dressing room and her clothes on rails, and I just brushed past one and it just powdered to dust. It was so... 20 years of dry atmosphere had just turned this thing. So you could almost blow on them and they would go. And I made my way up the stairs, and we have the cliche of the fertilizer bag in the window, but it was. Up into the loft, up into the granier, which was about a foot thick in beautiful, rich-smelling hay, which had been maturing for 20 years. And it's funny, after 20 years, hay becomes sweet. The smell of it just becomes this lovely, earthy smell. And there was a pigeonnier, which had pretty much collapsed because the acid guano had taken out all the wood, and you could grab handfuls of it. It was so rotten. And I just fell in love with it and went back home, told Karen about it, my wife, Kaz, and she basically said to me, "Look, you know, you've seen it. You know what we like. It's your decision." And I ummed and ahed. And on the following Monday, having had lunch with a great friend of mine, who I've never met anybody who likes a deal more than him, and we had lunch, and he asked me all these questions. Will it lose money if you buy it? And I said, yes, probably lots. But he culminated in it in, "Do you love it?" So all he said, "Do you love it?" And I said, "Yes." And then he said, "Then go and buy it, and I will buy lunch. And because I've persuaded to do so, I will get my week in your new house as my payment every year." And I bought it. And dear Ed Victor, who died some little time ago, was a great literary agent and an extraordinary man, never kept me to the deal, apart from pretty much every year. He would phone me up and say, "I'm not taking my week this year. A bottle of wine to my house would be rather lovely. Thank you so much." So that was how we came to buy it. There's a backstory to it. We actually saw another house before that, which we bought. But the people who we were buying it off were a father and a daughter. And we made the offer to the daughter and was accepted. And somebody else about 2 hours before us had made an offer to the father, who had accepted it 2 hours earlier. And of course this is practically illegal, but they found out, they phoned us and said, "Look, I'm really sorry, we've had this mix up." And we were fine about it. What can you do? And as a consequence, the immobilier, a chap called Freddie Ruder, who we still know now, he kind of put us at the front of the queue. So when new houses were coming on the market, he would phone us up and say, "Look, you've been really good about my mix-up. This goes on the market in a week's time. Have a look at it. If you're interested, you need to come and look at it in a week, but you need to pay the price for it." And I have this sort of image of this black market of houses going, you know, what do they call it? L'air du nez, where they tap their nose, you know, behind the counter at Royston Vasey, that sort of thing. But we were lucky to get behind the counter, and we were lucky to get the house. And it's been an adventure ever since.
You've explained something to me there that I've always wondered, why the French neglect their beautiful country homes and even chateaus at some point. I didn't know that about the inheritance, but it seems a little bit unfair, doesn't it, to me that, you know, we're always going over there and buying these beautiful houses from them. They just don't seem to hold them in the same regard as we do.
Well, that's very interesting. And, you know, of course, that's a great observation that we all make. And it's not at all that they don't like these old houses, and most of them have been families for generations. I mean, our house, the Petits who owned our house, they'd owned it for 150 years. But these places need an awful lot of upkeep. They are ferociously cold. I mean, these are houses that have 4 foot thick stone walls. And in summer, fantastic. You know, you close the shutters in the morning and so on. In winter, and I write about a winter, Christmas we spent in Côte d'Iveron, and the, what was it, the Hartley's or H.E. Bates's quote about the past being another country. The past is a very cold other country, I'm here to tell you. And of course, you know, to try and upkeep these places is very hard and it's very expensive. And so what people would do, they would create these lotissements around the small villages, which were housing estates, where they would build small bungalows, which were easy to heat. They could put a swimming pool in the grounds. You could get to them easily. They were easy to upkeep, as it say. They were new and so on. And as a consequence, those old houses would get sold off to people, incomers like us, or second homeowners. And of course there's some frisson there, there's no question about it, but as again, a part of the book I write about the mayor, who, there is a magazine in Coast called the La Garrigue, and the Garrigue is a oak scrubland that covers the ground, and it's very indicative of the area. And the local magazine is called La Garrigue. And in it, there was an editorial once about 10 or 15 years ago by the mayor, where he addressed this and said there's been some rumblings around the village about incomers coming and buying our old houses. And he took them to task. I mean, they're pretty finger-waggy, these mayors in France. And said, just you remember, you know, you're sitting in your warm house. These people are coming in, doing these places up, with local labour, by and large, and that's another thing I talk about, is how to get your builder, and it's an art. Don't get a builder from more than 25 kilometres radius, otherwise you're finished. And they're putting money into the economy. So, you know, just beckon up, guys. They're doing good things for us. And I think that that's the general consensus. And of course, as an incomer, you, like anywhere, you, if you move to a small village or to anywhere in any part of the world, you know, it's up to you to know that you are the arrivists and that you have to make yourself part of the community. They don't have to make you if they don't want to. So you have to follow certain conventions, you know, how to approach at the bar. Don't go buying drinks for everybody, you know. Understand that dogs in rural France are not pets, they're employees, you know, and not immediately walking to somebody in the street, shouting bonjour, shaking their hands and asking where the great best restaurant is. You don't do that. You have to wait to be asked. Say bonjour, of course. Be polite, but you have to wait for them to come towards you. And once you do all that, and there is a myth about taking a bottle of scotch to the mayor. You don't do that. But you have to sort of follow the instincts and make sure that you're not too pushy. And then that's fine. Everybody will take you to their hearts and make an effort with language. My goodness, my French is awful. It's terrible, but make an effort. They don't mind at all. And what's more, they love correcting you.
Describe to me some of the characters you've met there.
Oh, goodness. Well, I start the book with a fight in the square, which is at the Coast Fete. Every small village has a fete in the summer, which is for the village. And it's a bonding experience, and every village has its fete, and everybody has... And you're really not expected to turn up from another village and sit down, because it's usually a big trestle-tabled meal with wine and a bit of a sing-song or chanteur on a stage. And you're not really expected to turn up from other villages, sit down and go to somebody else's, some other town's, village's fete. Anyway, one guy turned up, this was some years ago, and it didn't go down too well. But I was standing next to the owner of the bar at the time, called Dido, And Dido was this extraordinary flamboyant character who believed that her fate was not to be a bar owner in a small inn in the south of France. The world had mistook her, and she should have been a painter in Pigalle, and she should have been an actress at the Moulin Rouge, and the world had conspired against her, and she would grab anybody she just and tell them how life has not been and she should be and why, and she would storm off. And then we had
we all feel like that.
Well, I was going to say, I sometimes I think, I wonder whether she made it, because she left the village not long later. I wonder whether she made it. I so hope that she made it, because she was so eaten up that the world had not treated her to this ambition. And then we had a wonderful old lady called Marie Claire, who I remember so fondly to this day. And she was in her 80s, and she'd lost her husband, and she would just wander the village and find places to sit, and people would talk to her, and she would wander into people's houses and take stuff.
We all feel like that sometimes too, I think.
But we're talking stuff from the fridge, you know. She would go into your larder and find a sort of gallon of really good olive oil and hoik it back to her place. She would, she would find pots and pans that would fit perfectly into her kitchen, and she'd take them back to her house. And the villagers knew this. And periodically, when she was out, they'd just go in and liberate their goods and take them back home, and Marie Claire would start all over again, and this was fine. So the place characters is one thing, but they're just, I used to think that, you know, these are the sorts of people who you would find in almost any English village or village anywhere. It's just that where we are, I always look at it at being maybe 50, 60, 70 years behind us. And there's good things to that, and there's bad things to that. But the good thing about it is that people are still given time to be who they want to be. And there is still judgment, of course. Small villages like small villages over the world over. You know, there are petty fights and things. But people are given room to be who they want to be. And we had... And bar owners being probably the key ones. And we had René and Patricia, who came after Dido. And René is this sort of Jean-Paul Belmondo character. And Patricia was quite the opposite, sort of Catherine of Padua, this extraordinary, volatile character. And whereas René was this sort of quiet, serene, and he used to walk up. He's gone now. He walked past in the mornings, and he'd just gently nod to you, and he'd smoke these gouloirs, black, and the smell, and then he'd drink this black coffee, which was like tar, and he'd just sort of nod his head and slightly lower his eyelids as he went past, in the sure knowledge that the day would be fine. It would be fine, and then Patricia would come out, René, there's nothing in the kitchen, the beer's gone, the wine is all off. And René would look at her and go, where? And then he'd finish his coffee as she carried on, he'd take another drag of his cigarette, and he'd get up heavily and go and sort out whatever it is that Patricia wanted doing. And she could sing, my goodness, she could sing. She was a proper chanteuse, but she'd only sing late at night when she was completely drunk.
This is idyllic. These are bar owners, village bar owners straight out of Central Casting, aren't they? They're exactly what you would have ordered.
Absolutely. And you know, she would get up at midnight and sing Edith Piaf better than Edith Piaf, usually aimed at René, who she remembered when she married him as being this. There was never a more beautiful man, she used to say. And of course, now he'd gone to seed, and he was in his 70s, for God's sake. And she would sing at him and lament the fact and say that he didn't care about her, and her arms would fly, and she would come, she'd stop singing, she'd throw herself on our shoulder and lament this man who had once been this beautiful and vivacious. And then suddenly she'd sober up, and she'd charge across and throw her arms around him and go, "Mon amour!" And I'm not making this up. They were wonderful. They still live around the area. And then my favourite of all, bar owners. I'm going to do a book on bar owners.
Oh, absolutely, please.
There is a restaurant in the mountains called Le Lizard Bleu, and it's one of those restaurants that is a sort of anachronism. There's more pizza places in France now. I think there are in Italy, and it's in a tiny little village on the side of a mountain, where the village looks as if it's been sort of placed. It looks like scree from a distance, and at the bottom of it is Le Lizard Bleu, and it's run by I think he's Dutch, that's right, Dutch, called Rick Cat. And Rick, so the story goes, and I tell the story in the book about how he came to be running one of the best restaurants, rural restaurants that I've ever been in. It's straight out of Peter Mayle, it's straight out of Narrow Dog, it's to Carcassonne, it's just lovely. And the story goes, and I've never asked him to verify it because the story's too good not to be true. And I don't want him to say, "Oh, no, that's all rubbish." The story goes that in the early 80s, he was came down from Holland to meet some friends at Rockerbrun. And Rockerbrun, with an E, is near Montan, which is on the border of Italy. Rockerbrun in the Languedoc is Noe and is about 3 miles from Vuzan and about 3 miles from us. And the story goes that he got the Rockerbrun wrong. So he ended up in Languedoc. His mates ended up in near Montan. And it's about 300 miles. So he decided, "I can't be bothered to make the trek." He met his now wife, Manu, married, took on Le Lizard Bleu, and the rest is history. And it's just the most wonderful place of an evening, watching the wind go through the trees and the stars come down, and driving back in pitch black where you would find, you know, wild boar kind of staggering across the road in your headlights, and the wonderful warmth coming up from the Garrigue. It's just the most romantic place you could possibly imagine.
What is your daily life like there?
Well, it depends. This is funny, but of course it depends upon the season. I mean, in summer, when it gets really hot, you know, 30, I think last week it was 38, 39 degrees, which is hot. The house is certainly our house with the big thick walls is built so that you know, you open the shutters during the night, shut them during the day so that the sun gets in, and it keeps pretty good temperature. But if it gets really hot, then the whole day shifts. So everybody is up at 5 o'clock in the morning, doing what they would have done at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. You know, the cars are out, deliveries, people going to the shops open much, much earlier. And then come 10 o'clock, everything stops because it's just too hot to do anything. And then about 7, 8 o'clock in the evening, everything kicks off again. And you can have promenade, you know, people, mothers with their kids in prams walking the streets because it's just that bit cooler. If it's not, and also that's when you go swimming. You don't go swimming during the day, but even if you've got a swimming pool, because it's just extraordinary. And we all swim in the River Orb, which is the most beautiful river, and there is a secret Coe's Beach, which is called Coe's Beach. It's about 4 miles away from us, and to find it you have to be taken there. It's like some sort of secret portal, and you go down a track, you go down another track, then you get out of your car and you go through a wood, and then you go through and down another track, and you burst open onto the River Orb in a valley with a cave up in the mountains behind you. And if you don't know where it is, you'll never find it. And then come 7 or 8 at night on a hot day, you go down there thinking, "Oh God, you know, I'll go for a swim. I'll make the effort." I go, and 3/4 of the village is there. They've got fires going, barbecues. I mean, it's like a beach at midday in Saint-Tropez. which is lovely because everybody's waving to each other. The dogs are in the water, you know, people are swapping stuff. That, you know, if you haven't bought any wine or you haven't got a call, or somebody will notice and they'll bring something over to you. So the days are really engineered around what the weather's like. Even if you're working, it's the same thing. Although I have to say, sometimes I do gratuitously go to the supermarket, which is ferociously air-conditioned, and wander the aisles aimlessly, buying stuff I have no idea what it is, just to keep cool for a little while. In the winter, it's very much different. The days are very short. It's cold. People don't quite figure, you know, they go in the holidays and it's cold. And when I mean cold, it, you know, it can be on sub-zero for days. And heating a house like that is almost impossible. We have a couple of big stoves, you know, wood-burning stoves that we keep going almost continually. And you close in on yourself. We close floors of the house. I say floors, as if we've got hundreds of them. We've got three floors, but we close one of them. We don't go out on the roof terrace. That's all closed up. And you kind of disappear into yourself. And people, it's funny, you go to the bars, you go to the restaurants, the Lizard Blue becomes a different place in the winter. No tourists. And you go in and, you know, Rick will greet you, and you know, the menu is thick and hearty in the winter, and you get put next to this big stone stove with drifts of grey ash underneath it that have been there for about 2 months, and it's sort of almost enveloping the stove. And outside, in the summer, as I was saying, the warmth of the wind. In winter, the winds, the doors are clattering, and everybody keeps their coats on. So it depends on the season, but everyone is different, and there's not a difference between people like us who own a house there. And we don't holiday. We do a lot of work when we're there, but when people, you know, the French who work there as well, their whole lives change in the same way.
It sounds like very much a stark contrast to your life over here, which I wanted to get onto, because we're sitting at the offices of Penguin, right opposite the brand new, I'd say brand new, it's quite new, the US
really
Embassy.
New. Isn't frightening,
it?
Yes.
It's quite frightening, quite imposing, very modern and almost insect-like, I would say.
Yeah, there's a carapace to it, isn't there?
Yes, yeah. And of the US Embassy. And you were working in publishing for a long time. So you also dropped into conversation just before I pressed record that not only did you work in publishing, but you also worked in music.
Well, not so much music. I was one of the first people who started the audio divisions of publishing houses, which was a fascinating proposition, because this was the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, when we were still doing tapes and CDs and abridgments. And I walked into my boss's office one day. I was the non-fiction publisher at the time of what is now part of Hachette. Walked into my boss's office with an abridged Maeve Binchy tape. And the book was Scarlet Feather, for anybody who remembers it. And it was abridged. And I'd got this tape in because it had been licensed to a company to produce. And I went into my boss and said, why are we licensing this stuff? You know, this is really popular and we should be doing them ourselves. You know, bit of investment we can do. And without looking up, he said, we don't license them. And he was quite an intimidated man. I mean, he was responsible for creating pretty much what half of publishing has become. And I was always kind of a bit worried if he started to confront me. And so I started to disbelieve my own eyes. He said, no, we don't license them. And I said, well, this has been licensed. And he said, no, you're not listening to me. We don't license them as of now. And as of now, you're the new audio publisher. I didn't know we licensed them. So off I went. And we created the audio division. And that was an extraordinary fun period, because it was when a lot of American actors and actresses were coming into the West End to plays, you know, whatever they were. And they would do six performances and a matinee. And most of them, once they'd got into the swing of it, would pitch up at the theatre at 6 o'clock, have a cup of coffee and go straight on. So they had nothing to do during the day. So we slip notes under the door and say, hey, we'll take you to the Ivy for lunch and we'll give you £1,000 and really look after you if you read this book for us. And to our utter surprise, they'd all go, yeah, fine, but don't tell my Hollywood agent, otherwise I'm in trouble. So we would have to do, well, how are we going to credit you and all this sort of stuff? But we had such fun doing that. And that was how I got into audio books, and what they've become now, of course, is a huge business, and rightly so. No longer abridged or full length, because all digital and so on. But prior to that, I got into publishing, and I talk about it in the book, not for any autobiographical reason, more because the book, parts of the book, are woven around the idea, are woven around memory and history and enthusiasms and passions. And I don't want to make the book sound too worthy, but that's what precipitated my thoughts, the house itself, because a 1,000-year-old house, you know, if you've got any antennae, you start to think about who lived there before, what were their lives like. You know, above the door and in the front door, there's a date scratched on the lintel, 1782. And, you know, you wonder who did that, because it is scratched in. So I started to talk about the sort of passions and enthusiasms and the things that had happened to me, silence and so on, which took me back to my start in publishing, because I didn't go to university. And today, that's actually come full circle. You would get into publishing houses today because we've realised over the last few years that it's not your academic ability, it's your ability to be able to take your passion and turn it into something that publishers like Penguin and Random House and so on can curate. And that was my big thing when I started in publishing. It was non-fiction, and I was very lucky because of the time that it was and the fact that I got into publishing in a really circuitous route and found that it was something utterly serendipitous. I found I loved books. I found I loved the whole thing. And my first person I worked for was a legendary man called John Murray the Sixth, who was the penultimate head of John Murray Publishers, one of the venerable publishers, and I worked for him. And like him, his father stopped him one day as a boy in the 1920s and said, John, would you do me the greatest of favours? Sir Arthur is coming in today, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Would you do me the greatest of favours? I believe he's bringing in the last volume of his Sherlock Holmes stories. Would you be good and receive them from him? And Jock Murray, in an interview he did with Paddy Lee Fermor just before he died, said, and I met Conan Doyle, and he said, he was so kind to me as this young whippersnapper. I said to myself, if this be an author, I want to spend my life with authors. And, you know, I kind of got that immediately. And that was the thing that really generated a passion in me for publishing, for books, for people, for authors, for the process of publishing, for helping people write books. And I go back to when I delivered my manuscript, I was the person on the other side of the fence saying, that chapter doesn't work, you need to do this, put that there. And I did that for perhaps 30, 35 years, working with some extraordinary authors. And it's an extraordinary thing as well to now be on the other side of the fence. And a really strange experience, looking at the whole process from a completely different perspective. And do you know what? I wish I had had the chops to do this 25 years ago, because I'd have made a much better publisher having gone through publishing my own book and knowing how authors put so much into it. Of course I knew that instinctively, but not emotionally and viscerally as I do now. So that's the sort of circle of events that brought me here.
Have you, throughout your working life before, did you travel a lot?
With authors, yes. A lot of my publishing towards the end, I used to work with quite a lot of big celebrities and help them put their books together. And as a consequence, you would end up, one of the last books I worked on with Phil Collins, and worked with him quite closely and spent time in New York with him and in Switzerland with him. And, you know, there's a strange bond that happens between somebody who is telling you about their lives, because it's unlike anything that a journalist can ever do or a TV interview can ever do. Although, you know, Nick Bloomfield is an extraordinary film biographer. But there is a sort of understanding when you are doing a book, and that is that you're allowed... There is a contract of respect and confidentiality, which is currency. But also there is this, you are, as a consequence of that, allowed to be quite impertinent and say things to them. Well, why did you do that? Why did you say that? What were you thinking when that happened to you? And for anybody outside of a family to say that to somebody, some of these big, big stars I worked with, you know, you just wouldn't get through the door. Their agents would look at you and go, uh-oh, no. But in those sort of circumstances, you had the license to do that, which was really fascinating. As a consequence, part of my job was not just publishing, but it was also to do with interviewing, getting the best out of them, being candid with them. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Often it did, because, you know, they wanted to do the best book they possibly can. So I was very lucky in being involved with those sorts of things. But I was also general narrative nonfiction. I don't know whether anybody out there remembers some books that were published in the early 2000s by Dave Peltzer, books, one of which was called The Child Called It, which was really what is rather pejoratively called misery memoirs, which I don't hold to. They're not all misery memoirs, and they're still going today. Kathy Glass, for example, publishes those. And it was the first book that... I bought it from the States. It was published by a small company, and it was a little book about Dave being physically abused when he was a child. And it was a small book, and it had been a huge bestseller in the States. And through one way or another, this book came to me, and I sort of walked around it for a little while because I didn't quite get it. And there was this assumption that these books wouldn't work in the UK because we're all stiff upper lip and we don't have our emotions on our sleeves. And I read it, and you know that he's going to be saved right at the beginning, and it goes on to be just him rather objectively talking about what happened to him. And it was a colossal... It sold millions of copies, and it started this whole genre. And that was a fascinating thing to be involved in as well, because it changed publishing a bit. There are certain books that do that. And for the good, because I used to spend, when it first came out, the tidal wave of people who read that, who had also been abused, was heartbreaking. And I and my assistant used to spend pretty much every Friday afternoon going through the letters and trying to reply to them, trying to say, tell them, you know, just replying to them so they didn't feel their letters had gone into the void. And some of them I remember to this day, which just make me almost weep. But what it did do, it was physical abuse, it wasn't sexual abuse, but a lot of the letters we were getting in were describing this, and it kind of opened, and I'm not suggesting it was that book alone, but it was just that moment when it broke open and started a conversation. And A Child Called It, I didn't really know perhaps why that book worked until there was a review in one of the newspapers, and there was a question at the end of the review, and the reviewer, whose name I can't remember now, or the commentator, said, I wonder whether this book would have been so successful if the abuser had not been his mother, if the abuser had been his father. And we found that so many women were buying this book because they couldn't understand how a mother could do that. You know, men are horrible, men do these sorts of things, but they couldn't understand that. And that, I think, was one small step to something that was good and opening up people and families to recognise when this sort of thing was happening. And again, I don't want to overstate it, goodness. It was just that little opener.
No, but I think it absolutely, books like that show the power that books and reading have to change people's lives. And actually bringing it back to your book, you talked about Peter Mayle and A Year in Provence, and that book in the 80s, it was responsible for hordes of people actually moving to Provence and changing their entire lives. And, you know, it's very conceivable that maybe your book will do the same.
Oh, I'll take the sales, definitely. I think it sold in the end something like 6 million copies, so I'll take the sales. But no, you're right. I mean, and to this day, 32-34 years afterwards, the Luberon changed. He changed it. And for the good or bad, I'm not sure. I think it was again a moment. But the thing about Peter Mayle's book is that it has the joie de vivre. You know, it's about food, it's about people, it's about not fun so much as just everything was optimistic about that book. And he wrote with such, you know, he was almost thrilled to be putting the words on the page. And I hope that I've tried to capture some of that. I hope it's funny. I hope that it's also in parts not so funny, because there are things that happen to us in that house which are very difficult for me to talk about. And when you read the book, you'll understand. And I don't want to make the book into a sort of mystery, but it is, it's not something that I can sort of explain or toss aside in a line. And as they used to say, well, why did you write? Tell us about your book in a paragraph. And often writers go, well, if I wouldn't have written the book if I could tell you about it in a paragraph. And the point is, I do address the things that happen to us. But they are all to do with, as I say, fun and fig jam and buying a bath in Chelsea and, you know, finding a way of getting that. And about the builders, about the bakers, about the people, about finding something where you can actually feel in the bones of somewhere peace. It's I try and explain it about everybody's looking for somewhere to belong, and it doesn't matter what it is, you know, a place, you know, a relationship, somewhere where you belong. And we're so lucky if we manage to find that even for a moment, no matter what that is. And one Place de l'Église became and has become somewhere where we belong, where we feel like we're part of a great stream of 1,000 years of history, and we're just a moment at the end of it. And I've said to people before that all those people who went before us are now sort of ghosts, and they're echoes of in that place. But you kind of, you know, I sometimes fancy, and there are no ghosts there, although it's built on a Visigoth graveyard, so which some people go, oh my god, Visigoth. So I believe that, you know, the good people remain. And, you know, out of the corner of your eye, you'll see something move and you go, oh, I wonder what that was. But I've never felt anything but warmth from the place. And I think that's because we gave back some of that warmth to it as well. And when we leave, who are the people who lived there for 1,000 years? Who knows? When we leave the house for the last time, we're going to leave two bottles of Picpoul, because Picpoul is the local hooch, which I talk about as well, lots about booze, and finding the mythical Picpoul Red there. That's a story in itself. So I'll leave two bottles of Picpoul, and I'll leave a copy of One Place de l'Église, so that in 1,000 years, our moment will be something people can go, ah, that's a punctuation point that I can find out about and know about.
Beautiful. I'm going to ask you my last question now. My last question is always about music, because I very much believe that music and travel go hand in hand. If I had to ask you to choose one song, if you had to choose one song that reminds you, of a moment...
How can you do this?
I know, it stumps a lot of people. I'll let you think of it. One song that reminds you of a moment, time and place of travel, wherever you might have been. You could be in France, you could be...
Do you know what it is? Traîner, Je Chante. It's just a song that makes your heart sing. Traîner was born just down the road from Cassivaron, and his little house is now a museum. And when we go down to France, Jacques Brel as well. Mm-hmm. When we go down to France, when we go to the village, we play Je Chante. That's the song.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
It has been absolute delight. Let's do it again.
Absolutely. For the next book.
Do it now again.
Let's do it again. Are you writing another book?
Well, you're going to persuade the publishers to take a second book or a copy as you come out of here.
You can persuade the publishers to publish my novel, which I think would sell really well.
It's a deal.
I've written it. Done. I just need to get it published. Done. You heard it here first.
Thank you so much for listening to the Big Travel Podcast. And thank you to Trevor, of course, for providing us with that lovely slice of life in France. We'll be back every couple of weeks with a brand new episode. Please give us a review and like and subscribe on whatever app you're listening to us on.